What a joy it is to be with you this morning. As a community minister who works mainly in Maryland and the District of Columbia, I don't get out your way very often. But the last time I was here, it was for the ordination of my friend and colleague, the Reverend Andrew Mertz. What a spirit-filled celebration that was. I work with faith leaders and community organizing groups working for justice, equity, and compassion. And I appreciate your invitation to share my thoughts on justice work. And it's been a real pleasure working with your worship team on this service. Before I start, I wanted to pause and mention where the title of the sermon comes from, Repairing the World. It comes from the Jewish concept of Tikkun Olam, repairing the world, which is a directive that Jews take seriously about their obligations in the world. I first learned about the idea of repairing the world in my Catholic high school. The school that I went to was in a small town outside of Cleveland, and it was the only non-public school in the city, and so it attracted a lot of non-Catholics. So one of the courses offered, instead of Catholic theology, was world religions, where I learned about Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, and many others as well. So I just wanted to put that in context for us. There's no shortage of justice work that needs doing in today's world. It's easy to get overwhelmed and end up doing nothing. How do we find the work that we are called to do and the faith and the strength to sustain it and ourselves for the long haul? I'd like to explore this by reflecting on three themes. What calls us, what we are called to do, and what sustains us. What calls us? 2 years ago, I was a ministerial intern for the Unitarian Universalist Legislative Ministry of Maryland. During the 90-day session of the Maryland General Assembly, which starts in January, many groups gather in front of the State House to rally for or against various bills. I remember a cold January day in 2016 when I joined other faith leaders calling for stronger police accountability in the wake of so many black men, young black men and women, dying at the hands of police. A reporter asked me why I was there. I went into a lengthy description of the bipartisan legislation, which called for having civilians on the official boards reviewing police misconduct, better police training on effective de-escalation tactics in dealing with those with mental illness, and more transparency with victims' families. But what I failed to mention was my faith as a Unitarian Universalist, which was what compelled me in the first place to be there. My strong belief in the inherent worth and dignity of every person, as well as justice and compassion in human relations, and that we are all connected in the web of life. Nor did I say that I had been working in Baltimore when 25-year-old Freddie Gray was found dead in the back of a police van, handcuffed behind his back, legs shackled, and without a seatbelt. In 2015. This was days after my own son, who was 24 at the time, he's white and he lives in Baltimore, was stopped by police for his car's broken taillight. He was let off with a warning, a verbal warning. And I wondered that day what story I would be telling if he were a black young man. Since then, I've realized the importance of connecting my justice work with my Unitarian Universalist values and in speaking out about the experiences that move my heart as well as my mind. Our principles call on us to recognize the worth and dignity of all people. Justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, and the interconnected web of life, which we are all a part. Beyond our principles, I'm also inspired by 20th century Unitarian Universalist theologian James Luther Adams, a minister, social activist, writer, and divinity school professor who died in 1994 at the age of 92. In 1935, Adams went to Germany to study with some of the great theologians of the time. There he saw that most of Germany's churches were not confronting the rise of Hitler. Reflecting later, Adams wrote, quote, "I pressed upon myself the question, if fascism should arise in the States, what in your past performance would constitute a pattern or framework of resistance?" Adams found that he could only give what he called a feeble answer to that question. Mainly, he said, reading the newspaper and voting, maybe a sermon on depression, on the Depression, or defending strikers, and an occasional protest against censorship in Boston. Hardly what he considered an adequate conception of citizen participation. Adams recalled repeatedly hearing during the time he was in Germany people saying, if only 100 of us, 1,000 of us in the late 20s had combined in heroic resistance, we could have stopped Hitler. Adams' experience in Germany changed him and moved him to actively confront evil and injustice. He got involved in what was then race relations, civil liberties, and housing problems. He joined others in forming the Independent Voters of Illinois. As a teacher at Meadville Lombard, Harvard, and other seminaries, he warned of the dangers of religion becoming complacent when resistance is needed. And he talked about what he called the prophethood of all believers, who judge and correct their society when it fails to confront injustice and uphold the worth and dignity of all. What are we called to do? Given the enormity of injustice in the world today, it's easy to despair or hide behind endless discussion and debate. So how and where do we start? The Reverend Kathleen Matigue, the director of the UU College of Social Justice, provides what I have found a good way to begin. It starts with saying yes. What injustices call to you? Where do you want to put your hands and heart to work? And also considering what is it that might be holding you back from saying yes. Then she moves to saying no, exploring your fears of what might happen of saying no to other injustices, working on other injustices, and realizing that your no can provide space for the work that you are called to do and say yes to. It's also important to consider your own gifts, figure out what piece of the work is yours, and see what's already being done and by whom, and how you can partner with these people and groups. And also, she says, it's important to engage in a regular spiritual practice to remain centered and spiritually grounded. Prompted by Reverend Matigue's approach, this year I have begun working on equitable public education for all children and youth throughout Maryland, regardless of their family's income or where they live. I'm part of the Partnership for Renewal in Southern and Central Maryland, a faith-based community organizing group that is working with educators, parents, and local communities in advocating for public community-based schools as a way of addressing current educational inequities among students. The best community schools provide high-quality teaching, engaging curriculum, positive discipline, and needed services that can help children in disadvantaged areas succeed. Sometimes it's free breakfast or health care or social and emotional services. They also stress community and family involvement and inclusive school leadership. I also work at Dress for Success in Washington, D.C., which outfits women in need with business attire for interviews and the first weeks on the job. It's great to see our clients leave feeling more confident about themselves as well as their job prospects. The nonprofit also helps clients with resumes, interviewing skills, and starting well on the job. So I urge you to find the injustice in this world that calls to you, that stirs your soul, and find a place where you can put your hands and heart to work and commit to the ongoing and deep work that seeks to address the root causes rather than simply treating the symptoms. Before I was a minister, I worked as an interim religious educator, helping congregations effectively work through the transitions that occur after the departure of a religious educator, a process not unlike the one you're going through here, but focused on religious education. What I discovered among the congregations I worked and among my colleagues working in other congregations was that many congregations often lack coordination among all of their groups doing justice work. And the result can be a scattered justice program with many offerings based largely on members' individual interests rather than some congregational consensus. And I wondered, how can congregations do more effective justice work that involves more of their members, regardless of age, and reaches beyond their walls? The late Carl S. Dudley, a Christian minister who focused on connecting congregations with their communities, recommended first looking at four areas: the congregation's social context, the place and the people around where the congregation is physically located; the congregation's identity, its unique faith and history, what has it done in the past, what is the work it's proud of; organization for ministry, how the congregation responds in ways that are consistent with the congregation's identity; and the congregation's partnerships, the relationships and commitments it has beyond its walls that broaden its base and provide stability for its justice work over time. Exploring these can help a congregation better determine what justice ministry might be a good fit for them and the community surrounding them. Justice work certainly can start with a few people, but it can't be sustained over the long haul unless they are joined by others who share their hopes for touching individuals, changing systems, and empowering people. What sustains us? We cannot do justice work for the long haul solely on our own. We need to partner with those doing the work beyond our walls. This includes other faith communities, community organizing groups, nonprofits, organizations, and others providing services and working to empower those marginalized and most affected. We must also lift up the interconnectedness of our lives with others. As the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all directly, indirectly. As long as there is poverty in this world, no man can be totally rich, even if he has $1 billion. As long as disease are rampant and millions of people cannot expect to live more than 20 or 30 years, no man can be totally healthy, even if he just got a clean bill of health from the finest clinic in America. Strangely, Dr. King said, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. And finally, we need to center ourselves and our work through spiritual practice. These regular practices quiet our minds and empty ourselves of the needless activity and put us in touch with the spirit of life and love that goes by many names and is beyond names. For me, it is daily meditating, journaling, and walking, or simply being in nature. There are many possible paths: yoga, singing, dancing, knitting, or whatever centers and nurtures your spirit. What's important is to find something that you can do daily, or as often as you can, with intention. As Mark Morrison Reed reminded us in this morning's chalice lighting, the central task of religious community is to unveil the bonds that bind each to all. There is a connectedness, a relationship discovered amid the particulars of our lives and the lives of others. Once felt, it inspires us to act for justice. It is the church that assures us that we are not struggling for justice on our own, but as members of a larger community. The religious community is essential for our vision, for alone our vision is too narrow to see all that must be seen, and our strength too limited to do all that must be done. Together, our vision widens and our strength is renewed. May we feel the bonds that bind us together and be inspired to act for justice. And may we find within this spiritual community a place where our vision widens and our strength indeed is renewed. Amen, and may it be so.